I will just say as we start that if you have not seen the Truth Project, I certainly encourage you to do so. Del Tackett is a Air Force friend of mine. In fact, he quotes me in the last segment of that series, and it is very well put together, and the content is excellent as well. Well, I was asked to amuse you before I abuse you, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite you to come to Gulf Shores in Alabama. That you want to get out of the harsh winter sometime. Normally, Gulf Shores, right there on the Gulf of Mexico, is going to be beautiful weather. There is a story that I've been told about a couple from my home state of South Dakota that decided to book a luxury resort there in Gulf Shores, there in the heart of winter. They were just ready to go down, and the wife got a notice that she had to go into the office for a business meeting the next day, and so they decided the husband would go ahead and fly down, and she would come down and meet him as soon as the meeting was over. So he flew down to Mobile and went across to Gulf Shores and checked into this luxury hotel, and first thing he did was take out his smartphone and send an email to his wife. Problem is, he got one digit wrong in her email address, and it went instead to the widow of a South Dakota pastor. The pastor had just died the day before, and the widow looked at the message and she shrieked and fainted, because here's what it said. It said, "Dearest wife, just checked in. Everything's set for your arrival tomorrow. Eternally yours, your faithful husband. P.S. Sure is hot down here." Well, it is hot in Alabama, but warm hearts down there too, and we'd love to have you visit us sometime. Now I'm going to abuse you with a quotation here that I think you might find very interesting. Talking about the neglect of the Christian religion, the neglect of biblical law, and what happens as a result. And I'm going to use the example of Nazi Germany. And when we think of all the wonderful things that Germany has given the world, the common law from the Anglo-Saxons of northern Germany, common law that was exported to Britain, which became Angleland, and then from there exported to the United States, the Reformation with Luther and several of the other reformers being from Germany and training others that were from elsewhere, the great music of Bach and Mendelssohn and so many others. I tell you though, I was on a Reformation tour there several years ago, and you see all of this wonderful heritage, you see those great cathedrals, you see the beautiful castle church in Wittenberg where Luther is buried, where he preached many times. You go to the cathedral where Bach is buried, and you hear the music floating through that cathedral as though Bach himself were there, the organ playing it. Almost feel like heaven. On Sunday mornings, they're almost empty. What has happened? Germany left behind its Christian heritage. They did so step by step. In the 1800s, you see the rise of religious liberalism, you see the rationalism of Hegel, and then the romanticism of Schleiermacher, and the higher criticism of Wellhausen, and the social gospel of Rauschenbusch, and the demythologization of Bultmann, and so many others like this. And so by the early 1900s, Germany had very little of its real Christian heritage left. And the old pagan gods simply reasserted themselves. Heinrich Heine was a German writer back in the 1830s. And in 1834, he wrote something that is very prophetic. He says, "Christianity, and that is its greatest merit, has somewhat mitigated the brutal German love of war, but it could not destroy it. Should that subduing talisman, the cross, be shattered, the frenzied madness of the ancient warriors, that insane berserk rage of which Nordic bards have spoken and sung so often, will once more burst into flame. The old Norse gods will then rise from long ruins and rub the dust of 1,000 years from their eyes. And Thor will leap to life with his giant hammer and smash the Gothic cathedrals. Thought precedes action, as lightning precedes thunder. When you hear a crashing such as never has been heard in the world's history, then you know that the German thunderbolt has fallen at last. At that uproar, the eagles of the air will drop dead, and lions in farthest Africa will draw in their tails and slink away. A play will be performed in Germany that will make the French Revolution look like an innocent idol. And of course, we see that fulfilled in the Holocaust and with the Third Reich, with National Socialism. I have never understood why Nazism is considered to be right-wing. It is exactly the opposite of that. In fact, National Socialism has its root in Darwinism, the idea that the German folk as an organism has evolved further and better than the others, and that the Jewish race is simply a malignant tumor or parasite on the German folk that needs to be extirpated, squarely based on Darwinism and statism, and it's the result of having gotten away from what the Christian religion has to say in regard to law and government. So let's talk about our duty to government. We've talked about what the duty of government is. Now what about our duty? And we're going to see that not only does that involve a duty to obey, but under other circumstances, it can involve a duty to disobey. And I'm going to ask that we look at Romans chapter 13 and verses 1 through 7, a verse that my guess is many of you probably could quote almost from memory. But question is, we're looking for this, Romans 13, who is Paul writing the book of Romans to? And if you can get this, my next question is, who is buried in Grant's tomb? To whom is Paul writing the book of Romans? I was giving a tour of Washington, D.C. last fall, and we went by the George Mason Memorial there. George Mason is called by many the father of the Bill of Rights, a very fine Christian founding father. And I told him, there is a law school here in the D.C. area that is named after George Mason. Can anybody tell me the name of that law school? Believe it or not, it took them quite a while before somebody finally came up with it. George Mason School of Law, by the way. But anyway, Paul is writing the book of Romans to Christians living in the city of Rome. And there isn't a copyright date on the book, but we believe the book is written somewhere around 60 AD, meaning that the Roman emperor is Nero, probably the most deranged emperor in history, and a man who would torture Christians. In fact, he would take Christians and wrap them in oil-soaked rags and tie them to posts and light them on fire as torches for his garden parties. He believed himself to be a Greek god and thought his mission was to bring Greek culture to Rome. Of course, he was eventually assassinated by the military, who decided they'd had enough of this guy. The guy was trying to escape, but he was extremely obese. And anyway, one funny thing is, as a lover of Greek culture, he also loved the Greek games, the Olympics, so to speak. And he would have these games regularly. And despite being so horribly obese, guess what? He'd always win. But finally, the military had enough, and they assassinated him. But Nero is the emperor when Paul is writing these words. And Paul says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Higher powers. That would have to include the emperor, and that would have to include the current emperor, Nero. Ordained of God. Utterly demonic, utterly despotic, and yet Paul says he's ordained of God. Whoso therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the revenger, the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. A very strong obligation that Paul places upon the Roman Christians and upon us to obey the civil authorities, even at a time when those civil authorities were obviously very, very despotic and very hostile to Christianity. And yet, Paul does not make this an absolute. If he did, it would conflict with other things we read. For example, in Acts 5:29, when the disciples are told not to preach Christ, and they respond, "We must obey God rather than man." But also, you see what Paul says here. He says, concerning the civil ruler, "He is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain." He goes on to say that if you would have praise of the civil ruler, obey, and then you will have praise. Do that which is good. Now there's an assumption here, and the assumption is that the civil ruler is commanding us to do what is good and is punishing those who do evil. What happens when civil government commands what is evil and punishes what is good? Paul doesn't address that situation here, but it is addressed elsewhere. And we could think of another passage that I think is also important, and that is 1 Peter, but then I'm going to get to a couple of Old Testament passages. But in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 13 to 17, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men." Once again, a strong duty to obey. And yet Peter is executed for the Christian faith. Paul is many times in jail. Peter is executed for his Christian faith. Obviously, they did not believe this obligation to obey is an absolute that applies in every circumstance. So let's take a look back in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1. And at this time, after the Jews have been brought into Egypt and treated very favorably because Joseph is really able to deliver them from a famine, and how much of Egypt's history might have been influenced by Joseph, even though he is not mentioned. The Egyptians commonly wouldn't mention any foreigner because they wouldn't want to give anybody credit for any of their success. In fact, you need to be very careful as you read through Egyptian history that, for example, when they're at war with the Assyrians, they will never admit in their histories that they ever lost a battle. But you see these battles recorded between them and the Assyrians. Every battle is getting farther from Assyria and closer to Egypt. But they're winning every one of them. But you recall what's happened here. The Jews have come in, and the Jews have been prosperous, and so much so that others are afraid maybe they're going to be too prosperous and too powerful. And so the Pharaoh issues an order that the midwives are to slay every male Hebrew child at birth. But we read in verse 19 of chapter 1, but the midwives feared God and did not, as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, "Why have ye done this thing and have saved the men children alive?" And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come into them. Which appears to be a lie, actually. And the Geneva Bible has a note under there saying that God approved their disobedience, but did not approve their dissembling or lying about it. And I would say that had they not lied about it, they would not have been able to continue their disobedience. But we go on to read that, therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. In other words, they had families of their own because they were faithful to God rather than to the Pharaoh. Now, the Pharaoh is the legitimate governor of Egypt, but he has given an order that contravenes the higher law of God. And so the midwives, out of their fear of God, disobey the Pharaoh and don't really tell the full truth when the Pharaoh asks them why they're not slaying the male Hebrew children. Here we clearly see that God approves an act of disobedience. We can look to the book of Esther, and there in the book of Esther, you recall that there is a man by the name of Haman, and Haman has a plot against the Jews, and that when Mordecai becomes aware of this, he asks Esther to go before the emperor and to expose that plot, but she's afraid to do so because under Persian law at this time, it is a capital offense to go before the king without an appointment. She's his wife, but she's probably one of many wives and probably not his current favorite wife, and so she's worried, I fear my lord the king. If I come before him without an appointment, he's going to chop off my head. And Mordecai says to her, if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another source. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And Esther is convicted by this, and she responds that she wants all the people, the Hebrew people, to pray for her and fast for her. And then she will go into the king, which is against the law, she says. And if I perish, I perish. An act of disobedience. I consider one of the best books of the Bible dealing with our responsibilities toward government to be the book of Daniel. You know, you think about Daniel, here is a young man who, with his companions, is taken from a devout home and taken to a foreign city in the east to be raised in the New Age cult of the Babylonians and the Babylonian public schools, put through 3 years of indoctrination there and intended to be a loyal servant of the Babylonian government. And this was Babylonian policy. Interesting the way God used the Babylonians and later used the Persians. Babylonian policy, when they conquered people, was to resettle them, break down their customs, their religion, their laws, their family structures, and melt them into thorough Babylonians. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do with the Babylonian captivity of the Jews. But then along come the Persians, and the earlier Persians are a lot different from what they become later on. But the earlier days of Persia under Cyrus, the Persian policy when they conquered was that if the king of this conquered nation would take an oath to be loyal to Persia, he could stay on his throne and they would keep their laws, their customs, their territory, their religion and the like. That was Persian policy. And so after, in 539 BC, King Cyrus the Great of Persia conquers Babylon, he sees these Jews in captivity and what are these people doing here? Well, they're Jews. They're from over there in Judea, and they've been taken captive here back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And Cyrus says, well, I think they should be allowed to return home, and he orders their return. Note how God used Babylonian policy to discipline the Jews when they needed discipline, and he uses Persian policy to restore the Jews when it is time for restoration. But Daniel is taken captive, and there in captivity, He and his friends are being indoctrinated in Babylonian custom and the like, and they're being put up in nice quarters, the visiting officer quarters there at the palace, and being treated to the king's diet of Chateaubriand every night, the king's drink and the king's meat. But Daniel refuses. He refuses that diet, apparently because it violates Jewish dietary laws. But when he refuses, notice what he does to begin with. He says to Melzar, who is the captain of the guard, he says that, "I can't eat this. It violates my Jewish diet." He doesn't simply say, "I'm not eating your pagan slop." Rather, he is respectful. He gets into a conflict situation, and he tries to work it out respectfully. And we're also told that Daniel had been brought into the favor of the captain of the guard. In other words, the captain of the guard has observed that Daniel is not a troublemaker. Daniel is not looking for excuses to disobey rules. That if Daniel objects to this, he must have a legitimate reason. But the captain says to Daniel, "Well, look, I fear my lord the king because, see, I'm responsible for your health. And if you eat that horrible Jewish diet, you might get sick. And I might lose my job. In fact, I might lose my head." Daniel doesn't say, "I don't care about that." Daniel says, "Put us on a trial for 10 days. Put us on the king's diet, or put us on our Jewish diet for 10 days and see the result. See if we get sick. I mean, we can't get too sick in 10 days, can we?" And so the captain agrees to this test, and at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his friends are the healthiest of the lot, and so they're allowed to continue. What do we get out of this? When we're in a conflict situation with authority, the first thing we do is to try to work the conflict out. And that's what Daniel does. And notice also, we'll be in a much better position to work out that conflict if the authorities respect us, if we have earned their respect. If they regard us as troublemakers who are looking for any excuse to complain, they'll probably disregard you. If they already respect you from their past dealings, they're much more likely to listen when you need them to listen. And so, they're allowed to continue on that diet. But then we go on to read in chapter 2 of this dream of King Nebuchadnezzar of the image with the head of gold, which represents Babylon, and the chest and arms of silver, and the body of brass, and the legs of iron, and the feet of mixed iron and clay. And as Daniel interprets the dream for him and says, "Thou art the head of gold," you in the Babylonian Empire are the preeminent head right now, but there are three empires that are going to come after you. Well, I think it all went to Nebuchadnezzar's head, and that's all he heard. "Thou art the head of gold." And so in chapter 3, we see where he raises this huge image, a golden image, not as it's described in chapter 2, but this one is all gold. And in keeping with Babylonian state worship policies, at the command of the music, everybody is commanded to fall down on their faces and worship that image. Daniel isn't mentioned in chapter 3. He's out in business for the empire somewhere, but his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to bow. And when the king tries to entreat them once more to do so, notice their answer. They say, "We are not afraid." Probably, "We are not careful" in the King James. "Afraid" is probably a better translation to answer thee, O King. "Our God, whom we serve continually, is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us, O King." Some have said that's the strongest statement of faith in the Old Testament. I think it's a strong statement of faith, but I think the real strongest statement is in the next verse. "But if not, we will still not bow before your image." In other words, they're saying, "We know God is able to deliver us. We believe God will deliver us. But even if he chooses not to deliver us, we will still be faithful to him, and we will be faithful unto death." Now, at this point, there is no compromise, no bowing of the waist or anything like this. At this, the clear choice is obey God or obey man. and they choose to obey God, and they are blessed in their act of obedience to God and disobedience to Nebuchadnezzar. Then we move on into chapter 6. And by this time, the Persians have taken power, and a decree has been issued. What has happened is we're told that all of the king's governors and princes and so on have come before him. He's, in typical Babylon, typical Persian style, divided the Babylonian province into 70 satraps or regions and put one satrap or governor over each one, with three princes over all of them, Daniel being the first of these three princes. Daniel, by this time, has to be at least 80 years old. He's no wet behind the ears kid. He's a seasoned statesman, and he knows exactly what is happening when these events take place. The others are jealous of Daniel, and they decide, we've got to get rid of Daniel somehow, and here's the way we're going to do it. First of all, they go through all of the records to try to find some way that they can catch Daniel in a scandal. They go through all of his tax returns. They check his expense vouchers to see if he's been charging personal expenses to the empire. They check the copy machine to see if he's making personal copies on the office copier. They check his phone bill, all these things. And he is clean as a whistle. Now, by conducting himself with integrity and by performing his duties with excellence, Daniel has placed his opponents in a difficult spot. They have to attack him not on the basis of any sin in his life or any incompetence in the performance of his duties, but they have to manipulate him into a position where he has to choose between obeying God or obeying man. As they say, we will find none occasion in this Daniel except we find it against him concerning his God. And so they come up with this decree that they get King Darius to sign. And this decree simply says that nobody shall ask anything of any god or any man except the king for the next 30 days. Now that is a stupid, stupid order. Because you can imagine how busy he's going to be for the next 30 days. But having a foreigner and needing to consolidate his power and gain the respect of the Babylonian people, he signs the decree. And when Daniel knows the decree is signed, and that word know is a word that means thorough knowledge, they say he's a seasoned statesman, he knows exactly what's going on here, he goes up into his chamber and with his windows open, and knowing that people are watching, he prays toward Jerusalem, as he has done daily throughout his life. Here again, he has a choice, obey God or obey man. He chooses to obey God. And notice as he does so, number one, he does so openly. He doesn't try to do it in secret. Daniel could easily have said, hey, I'm 80 years old. I don't need any of this nonsense. Two more years and I can get a pension and go out and retire and be done with this insane asylum. But no, he disobeys openly, knowing that he's being watched and being ready to face the punishment. And in fact, as he is delivered to the den of lions, by the way, any idea why Darius uses a den of lions instead of a fiery furnace like Nebuchadnezzar used? Darius is a Zoroastrian like the Persians. They believe fire is a sacrament. And so it would be a sacrilege to burn a body under Zoroastrian law. And so that's why he has to use this den of lions instead. But Daniel goes to the den of lions. He is respectful throughout the process. In fact, as he has been placed there, you know, the first thing that's happened when all of the others go and tattle to King Darius about what Daniel is doing, and anyway, so Darius understands what's happening. It says he is sore displeased, and he labored until sunset to deliver Daniel. He checked with his palace legal counsel to see about loopholes. He sends off a wire to the Persian Supreme Court to see if they can give a stay or something on this, but reminded repeatedly of the laws of the Medes and the Persians do not change. Now, that is a difference between Persian and Babylonian law. Persian law didn't change, and if Nebuchadnezzar had issued a decree on that, he could just simply say, what? I signed a stupid order like that. That order is hereby rescinded, and he can tear it up and throw it away. Darius can't do that, because under Persian law, the king is under the law, much more like a republic, at least in the early days of Persia. And so, when he is not able to find any way of delivering Daniel, he places Daniel in the den of lions, saying, "Thy God, whom thou servest continually, is able to deliver thee." And I think that was more of a hope than it was any real confidence. Daniel slept much better that night than Darius did. Daniel had some soft, furry pillows to sleep on. But in the morning, Darius comes down, opens the door immediately, and says, "Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God able to deliver thee?" That's not the right question. Of course, he's able. The question was, he willing? And what does Daniel say? "You stupid jerk, you shouldn't have put me in here." Yeah. No, he uses the standard form of address to a Persian king. "O king, live forever." And he talks about how God has delivered him. And it appears from the remainder of chapter 6 that Darius was a convert as a result. Well, what do we see out of disobedience from all of this? First of all, normally we obey. And we disobey only when we have made every effort to try to work out our differences. As some have put it, first of all, you negotiate. If that fails, you legislate. Try to get the law changed. If that fails, you litigate, go to court. If that fails, you don't capitulate, you regurgitate or whatever. But at that point, you need to disobey. And when we disobey, we do so openly. When we disobey, we know that we are probably going to be punished for our disobedience. In fact, the question I would ask is, did Darius sin by putting Daniel in the den of lions? You could perhaps say he sinned by signing that decree. It was a sin of stupidity, if nothing else. But he was bound by the law. And a good question, was that a sin? But the point is, Daniel, even though he was blameless, accepted punishment. And even in disobedience, we show respect. Now I'm going to go on to talk about something that many people would think is the same thing as civil disobedience, but it is really quite different. And that is the doctrine of interposition. Can anybody define interposition for us? Go ahead.
The opposite of outer position?
The opposite of outer position. This man must be a lawyer. I knew that last night when he said, "I've enjoyed your lectures so far." He left himself a loophole. That answer is completely correct. It is the opposite of outer position. But I'm going to tell you another story here. We've got a little time. We go till 11:30, is that right? Okay, we've got some time here. I'm going to tell you a story here about two men that are in a hot air balloon, and they're flying over a cloudy area, and they're lost, so they lower the balloon through the clouds and down below, and they see a forest below them, and there's a path down below them there, and they lower themselves, and they see a man walking on the path. They get down within earshot, and they yell down at the man, "Where are we?" Man looks up, "You're in a balloon." And one says to the other, "That man must be a lawyer." "Well, how do you know that?" Well, the answer was directly on point. It was completely responsive. It was entirely correct. And it didn't tell us a thing. The difference is the man on the ground probably didn't send them a bill. But interposition. We think about that hymn, "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing," and that line, "He, to rescue us from danger, interposed his precious blood." What did he do? Placed his blood, placed himself, the blood of the cross, between us and our sin and the righteousness and justice of God. Now, in the political sense, we use that term interposition for the act of a lesser magistrate, that is, somebody maybe from state or local government, standing up against a higher magistrate, perhaps a federal official, or in England, the king, when that higher magistrate has become a tyrant and is usurping the rights of the people and acting contrary to the law of God. Now, we see an example of interposition as we look to 1 Kings chapter 12. And as we saw the monarchy, as the monarchy is developing there, first of all, we've had these 400 years of government by judges, not a perfect time. We read that in those days there was no king in Israel, and each man did what was right in his own eyes, and that is at best a mixed blessing. But the people demand a king, and they're given Saul as a king. Now, Saul had some good qualities. He looked the part of a king. He had a good military record. He is a humble man, at least at first. And in fact, as a humble man, one of the first things he does when he's told he's anointed to be king is that he insists on finding the will of the people and making sure they confirm him as king, the consent of the governed. And once he is coronated as king, and his supporters say, "What about those that didn't support you? Shall we go out and kill them?" And he said, "No man shall be put to death today, for in this day the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel." He's off to a good start, and he has some good qualities. But it goes downhill from there. And we see that concern about the will of the people degenerate into an obsession with popularity. David comes along, and you recall what happens, that they come back from battle, and the women are all singing the praises. "Saul hath slain his thousands." "Oh, yes, I am quite a warrior." "And David his 10,000s." Now, he doesn't like that line quite so much. And he sees David coming up as a rival. Now, what do you do when somebody is rising up as a rival in your social club or in your school or on your athletic team or maybe in your church? Somebody seems to be getting more attention than you are and possibly may become the next student body president or the next team captain instead of you. What do you do about that? Best thing to do is to make that person your ally. Say to that person, "I really love the way you do those layup shots. Can you show me how to do that?" Everybody loves to be asked that. Make that person your ally. And it's pretty easy to do most of the time. What Saul should have done is made David chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then Saul would have benefited from David's victories. Instead, he does what we're all way too likely to do, and that is try to cut his opponents off, sees David as a rival, so tries to cut him down, and as a result, they simply start destroying each other. Wrong, but all too common. And Saul finally is in despair, and in the end years of his reign, they're no longer winning victories, they're being defeated, and they're being attacked on all sides. And what does he do in this situation? Well, first of all, he prays to God, and God does not hear his prayer. The reason why is he's in a state of apostasy. God doesn't always listen to your prayers, and there are times when, believe it or not, there are times when you shouldn't pray. There are things you shouldn't pray about. I've even heard of couples in a state of adultery praying to God, "Show us what we should do here." And God's answer to that is, "I told you the answer to that in the Ten Commandments. You don't need to ask me that again." The only prayer at that time is, "Lord, give us true sorrow and true repentance so that we may come back to your laws." God doesn't answer his prayer because he's in a state of apostasy. So what does he do then? Repent? No. He goes to the witch of Endor. And as a result of all of this, he knows better than that, by the way, in his early years, he expelled all the witches. But as a result of all this, the prophecy comes that he will be slain in battle tomorrow. And that's the result. Now, after all of this, you would think Israel would be thinking, "Well, maybe Samuel was right all along. Maybe we shouldn't have a king." And maybe we're thinking as we read this, "Well, if God had known what a disaster Saul would turn out to be, he certainly wouldn't have anointed Saul." Guess what? God knew. And he anointed Saul anyway. Why? Maybe to demonstrate to the people that a king was not really the right thing for them, that they should be a constitutional republic. But the people don't get the message then. They don't get it at the death of Saul. And David becomes king and reigns as Israel's greatest king. But David also expands the power of the monarchy, and that is expanded much further than under his son Solomon. And Solomon, of course, builds Jerusalem into a showplace capital, and people from nations all around come, the Queen of Sheba for one, and he has all these palaces and gardens in Jerusalem at this time, but also he's imposed some heavy taxes, and there is a lot of discontent over these heavy taxes, and he has imposed workforces of mandatory labor that apparently includes Jews as well as it includes foreigners. And so when he dies and his son Rehoboam becomes king, at this time we see the people demanding some kind of relief. And let's take a look at 1 Kings chapter 12. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass, when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt. Jeroboam had been a rival of Solomon and had to flee. Now he hears Solomon has died, so maybe this is my opportunity to come back. And so we have a conflict between these figures, the son Rehoboam and this opponent Jeroboam, who has a lot of support in the 10 northern tribes. After all, the Davidic line of kings is from Judah, and they have the support of Judah, but some of the 10 northern tribes have never been fully happy with the tribe of Judah, which is referred to as the house of David. They sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam. Now, when it says all of the congregation of Israel, Israel by this time probably has a population of several million. Rehoboam does not have a PA system capable of addressing a crowd of several million. Is this mic working? Could you hear me in back? But anyway, the congregation of Israel that comes here is probably something like a House of Commons or a House of Representatives. The local tribal judges, the leaders of the 12 tribes and of the clans within those 12 tribes, these are the ones that come before Rehoboam at this time. Israel has not only a king, but they have divided power. They also have the council of elders, the 70 elders that eventually become the Sanhedrin. And they appear to have a lower house as well, this House of Commons. And this House of Commons comes before Rehoboam, and Jeroboam is there kind of egging them on. And here is what they say. Verse 4, "Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous servant of thy service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he said unto them, Depart yet for 3 days, and then come again to me. And the people departed." And so now we have a request. Give us some tax relief. Give us some relief from this forced labor and the like, and we will be your loyal servants. And Rehoboam is asking for some time to think it over. So we read that he consulted with the old men, those who had served Solomon before him, and the old men say, he says, "How do you advise that I may answer this people?" And they spake unto him, saying, verse 7, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and will serve them, and answer them, and speak good words unto them, then they will be thy servants forever." What he's saying is, these are loyal people. They'd like to serve you, but they've got some legitimate grievances here. We think this would be a good time for you to put in some tax relief, and if you do so, they will be thoroughly supportive of you for the rest of your reign. Well, maybe. But then he turns to the younger advisors. And how do you advise? And they say to him, verse 10, "And the young men that were grown up with him spake to him, saying, Thou shalt speak unto this people that spake unto thee, saying, Thy father hath made our yoke heavy, but make it thou lighter to us. And thus say to them, My little finger is thicker than my father's loins, And now, whereas my father did laid you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. For my father hath chastised you with whips, I will chastise you with scorpions. And Rehoboam says, you're right. Crack down. This is no time to show that you're weak. Give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And so, on the third day, Jeroboam and all the people came back to Rehoboam, and the king answers and spake to them in verse 14, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. 300% tax increase, effective retroactively. And the 10 northern tribes say, what have we to do with the house of David? To your tents, O Israel. And the 10 northern tribes secede and form the Northern Confederacy. And from that point on, the Northern Confederacy is called Israel. And the southern tribe of Judah, with the aid of Benjamin, they become Judea thereafter. And the kingdom from that point on is divided. Now, the fact that the Bible tells us that these people practiced interposition doesn't necessarily mean that interposition was the right thing to do. But let's read just a little bit further. And we read that Rehoboam is building an army to go up there and reconquer the northern kingdom. But when we read in verse 21, and when Rehoboam has come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men, which were warriors to fight against the house of Israel, to bring the kingdom again to Rehoboam, the prophet son of Solomon. But the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, speak unto Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and say unto him, say unto all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the remnant of the people, saying, thus saith the Lord, ye shall not go up, nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing is from me. They hearkened therefore to the word of the Lord, and returned to depart according to the word of the Lord. The prophet of God advises Rehoboam that in some way this act of interposition is of me, that God is behind it, and therefore Rehoboam rather reluctantly accepts it. Now, the results are not entirely good, but we can't always judge a principle by the results. The northern kingdom rather quickly falls into apostasy. The southern kingdom also does so, but a little more slowly and with a few periods of revival mixed in. But at any rate, here we see an act of interposition and an act that is blessed. Now, let me give you another act of interposition. And this occurred in the year 1215, a very important year in English constitutional history. What happened that year? Anybody recall? Magna Carta. A couple of years ago, we celebrated the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, except that 90% of the people didn't know it was being celebrated, or if they did, they didn't know what it was. What had happened here? Well, after the rule of the Anglo-Saxon kings, which they tended to be very limited monarchs and chosen by consent of the Witana Gemot, which was the Anglo-Saxon parliament, but after the Norman conquest of 1066 under William the Conqueror, we now have Norman rule imposed from the continent. And the Normans, who are a mixture of Norse and French, but they are following French law, which was essentially centralized Roman law. And for several hundred years thereafter, we see a constant battle in England between those who want to preserve the old Anglo-Saxon common law and those who want to centralize things with Roman law. And then we come to a series of kings there, the Plantagenets. And we have, for example, Richard the Lionhearted, who is a man I would admire greatly. But it has to remember, Richard, that as great a leader as he was in the Crusades, in his 10 years as King of England, he spent less than 6 months in England, and he wasn't sending tweets or faxes or anything else. And so by the time he died, England was in something of a shambles. And then comes King John, who who has nothing of Richard's good qualities and many, many bad qualities. I guess the only good thing you could probably say about John in his defense is that he inherited a lot of problems that were not of his making. However, he made them worse. And so he tries to make them worse by cracking down as a tyrant. And then there arises a man that I consider to be one of England's greatest constitutional heroes, a man by the name of Stephen Langton. Stephen Langton was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest religious official in England of the time. He came from the area north of the Danelaw, meaning he was probably of Scandinavian origin and probably would have been steeped very much in Viking law rather than either Anglo-Saxon or Norman law. But when he saw the tyranny of King John, he called the barons and the bishops together, the local officials, the gentry of the Anglo-Saxons and their Celtic and Viking allies and their allies among the Scots as well. He calls them together. He reads the old charter of the King William II, in which the ancient God-given rights of England, of Englishmen, had been recognized. And he instructs them on the doctrine of interposition. He tells them it is their duty as bishops and barons to stand before the king on behalf of the people who are their charges, because King John has become a tyrant. And so Stephen Langton at that point either draws up the Magna Carta or supervises its being drawn. We're not sure how much he actually wrote it, but they meet with King John there at Runnymede, and they basically tell King John, look, you either sign this document in which you agree to, first of all, respect the independence of the English church, and secondly, you agree to respect the God-given rights of Englishmen, or else you're going to be looking for a job. And there aren't a whole lot of king wanted ads in the newspapers of Europe right now, John, and we're not going to give you good recommendations. Well, John signs against his will, and he tried to claim later he signed under duress and it was therefore invalid, but at any rate, oversimplified, that is one of the most supreme acts of interposition in history. And interestingly, at the same time, you have a Roman Catholic theologian who is speaking about the duty of interposition. Most of you probably heard of Thomas Aquinas, and you might call him as one of the two or three most influential theologians upon the Catholic Church. I would say Augustine was probably more influential on the church as a whole, because Augustine had the respect of Luther and Calvin and the Protestants as well. But Aquinas possibly influenced Catholic theology more than Augustine did. But Aquinas talks about when a king becomes a tyrant. And when a king becomes a tyrant, he says it can either be by, number one, the king usurping authority wrongly, in other words, a coup d'etat, he takes over, or another way a king can become a tyrant is by assuming authority lawfully and then using it unlawfully. Either way, the king has stepped outside of the law of God, he has become a tyrant, and he has forfeited his right to rule. And then, he says, anyone who chooses to do so has a right to do what he calls tyrannicide. Now, that's not a species of dinosaur. Tyrannicide means killing a tyrant. But, well, Aquinas says killing a tyrant might be lawful. It's not always the expedient thing to do. Because he said, for one thing, you may try to kill the tyrant and fail, in which case the tyrant may just crack down and be more tyrannical than ever. Or you might succeed, in which case what comes after the tyrant? Those who take power after him may see what happened to the previous tyrant and they're determined to prevent that from happening to them, so they crack down and become worse than the tyrant they overthrew. There is a saying that under capitalism, man exploits his fellow man. Under communism, it's the other way around. But maybe you need to think about that one for a moment. But anyway, he says, what is better is to prevent tyranny from taking place. First thing he says is to have a process by which kings are selected to make sure that only those of the soundest character will become kings. And secondly, when you have done that, then place all sorts of checks on the king's power so that he can be held in check by lawful authority rather than just by somebody slaying him. What he is saying is, first of all, select good people to be kings, but secondly, have in place powers of interposition. We have those powers here, that we limit a president to 2 4-year terms. If we don't like him, if we don't like what he's done, we don't have to re-elect him. But if he has been so bad that we can't even wait till the next election, rather than overthrow, we have the power of impeachment. And so there are checks and balances that we have here, and Thomas Aquinas is writing in the 11 and 1200s. Obviously, he didn't see the United States Constitution. If he had, I think he would have approved. But I can go on, and I can talk about Luther and Luther's view of interposition, which Luther was a little bit negative about this at first, but actually Luther's whole ministry was saved by an act of interposition. You recall when Luther stood before the Diet of Worms there, and he said, "My conscience is bound by the word of God, and it is not safe nor wise to go against conscience. Here I stand. I can do no other. God help me. Amen." And he is then declared an outlaw by the Holy Roman Emperor, and the emperor gives a command that anybody who finds Luther is to capture or slay him. Well, the governor or elector of the province of Saxony, Frederick the Wise, interposes on Luther's behalf. Now, Luther had long been an advocate of the old Teutonic common law against the centralizing features of Roman law. You recall Luther had studied for law, and shortly before he completed his studies, you recall the account of what happened. Luther at that point had been traveling through a thunderstorm, and he was scared of being struck by lightning, and so he made a vow to St. Anne that if she would enable him to return home safely, he would forget his legal studies and become a monk. Well, some of us think that he made up that story because he didn't want to take the bar exam, but at any rate, and so Luther, in his study of law, loved the old common law, and he loved Herman the Liberator, who had defeated the Romans at the Battle of Teutoburg Forest and preserved the Saxon common law of the North. But anyway, what I'm saying is one of the reasons, I don't think the main reason, but one of the reasons the Northern princes were so supportive of Luther against the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor is not only that they agreed with his theology, although I think they did, but also that they liked his view of common law. But anyway, the Holy Roman Emperor has decreed that Luther is to be captured or killed, but the governor of Saxony, Frederick the Wise, interposes, refuses to carry out the order, and to prevent it from being carried out by somebody else, he stages a kidnapping of Luther. Luther is brought up to Wartburg Castle, there on a hilltop, and there he is given the name Knight George, and nobody, Junker Jorg, as the Germans would say, and even the people of the castle did not know who he really was. He remained in hiding there for a year, and he used that time to translate the New Testament into German. But Luther's ministry and Luther's life is saved by an act of interposition, and Luther becomes a strong advocate that the northern princes have a right and a duty to interpose when the higher authorities are commanding contrary to the word of God. I could show where Calvin says much the same thing, particularly in chapter 20 of book 4 of the Institutes. I could talk about John Knox and John Knox's stand against Queen Mary, not Bloody Mary, but Mary Queen of Scots there in Scotland, where he defies her and informs her that, yes, princes, even when they rule, that their subjects have a right to disobey them when they are contrary to God's word. And anyway, by the way, in fact, I'm going to take a moment here I guess we have time here. I'm going to take a moment and just read a very small portion of what John Knox says in his exchange with the Queen. I think you'll find this fascinating. Queen Mary, who also knows Scripture, she's Roman Catholic, she also knows Scripture, she says to John Knox, "But ye have taught the people to receive another religion than their princes can allow. How can that doctrine be of God, seeing that God commandeth subjects to obey their princes?" Knox answers, "Madam, as right religion took neither original strength nor authority from worldly princes, but from the eternal God alone, so are not subjects bound to frame their religion according to the appetites of the princes. Princes are oft the most ignorant of all others in God's true religion, as we may read in the histories." And then he goes on to say, "If all men in the days of the apostles should have been of the religion of the Roman emperors, what religion should there have been upon the face of the earth?" And I'm skipping over quite a bit here. Queen Mary said, "Yea, but none of these men raised the sword against their princes." And Knox says, "Yeah, madam, you cannot deny they resisted. For those who obey not the commandments that are given in some sort resist." Queen Mary said, "But yet they resisted not by the sword." And Knox says, "God, madam, had not given them the power and the means." Queen Mary asks, "Think ye that subjects having the power may resist their princes?" Knox answers, "If their princes exceed their bounds, madam, no doubt they may be resisted even by power." Then he goes on to say, "So it is, madam, that if a father is stricken with a frenzy, in the which he would slay his children. Now, madam, if the children arise, join themselves together, apprehend the father, take the sword from him, bind his hands, and keep him in prison till his frenzy be overpast, think ye, madam, that the children do any wrong? It is even so with princes that would murder the children of God that are subjects unto them." But, by the way, you think of this rather abusive, big, powerful guy standing up against this poor little queen. Queen Mary was about 6 feet tall. John Knox was about 5'4". A little puny guy, but obviously a giant in spirit. Well, then we go on to another example of interposition, and this is with the battle between the king and the parliament in England. The parliament, which is controlled by Puritans, is against the king, and the king obviously holds the royalist view of the divine right of kings. And the dispute between the Stuart kings, James and Charles I, and then Charles and James II, if you read most histories, they'll just tell you, this is dealing with the subject of divine right of kings. If that was the case, if that's all there were to it, I would side with the Stuart kings, because I believe, as I assume all of us believe, that all governmental authority comes from God. But the Puritans also believed that government authority comes from God. And the real dispute was this. The Stuart king said God is the source of all authority. He gives authority to the king. The king then delegates authority to these lesser rulers, the parliament perhaps, and the local magistrates. And they rule over the people in the name of the king, who in turn rules in the name of God. Now the Puritans said, no, God is the source of all authority, but he gives that authority to the people. The people then delegate authority to the lesser magistrates, and they delegate authority to the king. So where the king is the higher magistrate, in a sense, he's really the lower magistrate, because he is subject to the lesser magistrates, and it is their right and their duty to restrain him when he is out of line and remove him if he is incorrigible. And they, in turn, are subject to the people. And the people are subject to God. Again, the state motto of South Dakota, under God, the people rule. Then we see that conflict once again in America. We saw that the Continental Congress, first of all, objected to various taxes, and they objected to these taxes on the ground that the Parliament had no authority to impose these taxes, because the basic principle that goes way, way back to the Magna Carta itself, principle of no taxation without representation. Only the lower house of parliament, the House of Commons, could impose taxes, because They are the body that represents the people, and it is the people who impose the taxes. Our Constitution has a very similar provision. Our Constitution says all bills for originating revenue have to originate in the House, because at that time the Senate was appointed by the legislature. The legislature doesn't pay taxes, the people do. So the body elected by the House of Representatives, has to originate taxes. That is one of the reasons I am convinced that Obamacare is unconstitutional. It originated in the Senate, not in the House. And we have argued that in several briefs to the court. They haven't gotten to that argument yet, but in this case that several states have now presented to the court and which may be litigated to Obamacare once again, now they're saying that since you don't have that penalty anymore, the individual mandate and penalty has been eliminated, now the issue arises again, and so we'll see what happens this time. But at any rate, because of this, Parliament first of all, or the Continental Congress first of all, objects to the taxes imposed by the King and by the Parliament. And their argument is, number one, only two sources of authority exist in England. One is Parliament. Parliament has authority only over areas where they have representatives. We have no representatives in Parliament. Therefore, Parliament cannot tax us. Now, there's another side of the story. Parliament had offered representatives to the colonies, but the colonies refused because they knew that would jeopardize their case for independence if they ever wanted to present it. And the second source of authority in England was the King. They argued the King has no authority over the colonies because the colonial charters were granted by the Stuart kings, James and Charles I and Charles and James II. And when the Stuart kings were overthrown by the Hanover dynasty, the authority of the monarchy over the colonies had evaporated as well. That might be a weaker argument. But as a result, when the King disregards the olive branch petition presented by the Continental Congress practices what is probably the most supreme act of interposition in all history, the Declaration of Independence. And you recall, they appeal to a higher authority, the laws of nature and of nature's God. They appeal to these self-evident truths of being created in a state of equality and natural rights. And they go on to say that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that when government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish that government and to institute another that is more conducive with those ends. Jefferson goes on in the Declaration, and sounds like he's even read something from Thomas Aquinas here. He said, sometimes if they're only minor abuses, it might be better to just suffer them. But when there's been a long train of abuses, then it is the right and duty to resist and abolish that government. And so now he goes on to the second part of the Declaration, the statement of grievances. These are the examples of tyranny that justify interposition. He goes on from there to say, we've tried all lesser means to get the King and Parliament to listen to our complaints. They won't listen. And therefore, we conclude that George III is unfit to be the ruler of a free people, and these colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states. That is the act of interposition, and the War of Independence is not a rebellion. It is simply shaking off a foreign power whose authority had ended because it had become illegitimate. Alexander Hamilton said shortly after the war that not really has changed that much in America. The laws are the same. The local officials are the same. Property is in the same hands. All that has changed is the seat of government. And the American War for Independence is not a rebellion. I think it could be more properly titled just that, the War for Independence, or the War Against British Aggression. Well, that gives you a little idea of the doctrine of interposition. And I think there are times when a lesser magistrate has a duty to interpose. I'm thinking of the example of Judge Moore with the Ten Commandments in Alabama, and I'll just simply say on that the posting of the Ten Commandments in a judicial building, first of all, does not violate the Establishment Clause. But secondly, I will say that no federal court has an authority to tell the people of Alabama how they should decorate their courtroom. And I would argue then that those are wrong who say that Moore should have resigned rather than refuse to carry out that order. He had been elected by the people of Alabama to represent and protect their rights. Had he simply resigned, he would have betrayed his trust to his people. He had a duty to interpose on behalf of the people of Alabama against a federal judge who had issued an unlawful order. And yes, I think the duty of interposition applies. I think it applies across the board. I don't think any government official should rule without the recognition that if he pushes people way beyond his authority, they may dig in their heels and resist. And I see no reason to think that unelected federal judges should be the only exception to that rule. Well, we have come to 11:30. I'll be glad to stay around and talk with people as long as we have here until I'm called out of here to lunch. But I've certainly enjoyed being with you here. I'd love to come back again sometime, and hopefully we can arrange that. You have some excellent speakers coming up. But thanks to Dick Pence for all he has done to organize this worldview forum, as well as those that have taken place before or those that are coming. And I urge you to support this conference, support Dick and the work that he and Nancy are doing here and all those that have helped. But it's been a great pleasure. God bless you. And thanks for that. Thank you, John. Thank you very much.